Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Speaking in Maine today takes us to Waterville for a special address by former Senator George Mitchell, speaking to the Maine Council of Churches. This program can be heard on our website, mainepublic.org, where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast. Introducing Senator Mitchell is Bonnie Radden, President of the Board of Directors of the Maine Council of Churches.
Thank you all for coming. Many of you have come from very far away, and it's obviously a big deal to be here. And we appreciate it, and we know why you're here, and it's not for me. Welcome to the special address by former United States Senator George Mitchell. I am Bonnie Radden. I'm president of the Maine Council of Churches, of our board of directors, and we are sponsoring this event today. I'd like to explain a few things about the Maine Council of Churches and the program today. When your heart cries out for refugees, fleeing war and desperation, we want you to know we're one of the organizations looking out for refugees in Maine. When you find it unfathomable that 1 in 5 children in our state lives in poverty, we want you to know that we are in Augusta advocating for legislation to change that sad statistic. And when the words of our political leaders leave you aghast, we want you to know it is the Maine Council of Churches that stands up and says, enough. We advocate for the poor, the downtrodden, and the disenfranchised. In God's name, because our Christian faith calls us to watch out for one another and to treat each other as we want to be treated. We are composed of 9 denominations, Roman Catholic and 8 Protestant, Episcopal, Evangelical Lutheran, Presbyterian, Methodist, Quaker, United Church of Christ, Unitarian Universalist, and Swedenborgian. Among our 9 denominations, we have 550 churches in Maine. We partner with secular organizations to accomplish more. One of the most significant roles of the Maine Council of Churches is holding elected officials accountable for speaking respectfully to each other, even when they disagree. We've asked congressional and legislative candidates to sign our covenant for civil discourse, and nearly half of them have. You can check their names on our website, www.mainecouncilofchurches.org. A few weeks ago, I was staffing a table for the Maine Council of Churches at the Common Ground Fair and really freezing. Of the many people who stopped by, it was the words of the teachers that resonated most with me. Day after day, we teach our students to be kind to one another, they said. We teach them to treat each other with respect. We teach them that bullying is unacceptable and we won't tolerate it. We teach them from the day they first enter kindergarten and sit in a circle and hold hands. And yet now, when our children should be learning how democracy works, we can't let them watch the national and local news because the people who are supposed to be heroes to our children and role models are bullies themselves. It is so disheartening. We feel disillusioned, disgusted, and helpless. And that's why our board of directors decided to seek help from a Maine-made hero. We are eternally grateful to board member Cush Anthony for reaching out because he's the one who convinced Senator Mitchell to come today and answer the burning question, from mudslinging to mutual respect, how can we make politics more civil? If anyone can answer that question, we have faith that Senator Mitchell can. He is one of the most revered statesmen in the history of Maine and our nation. with grace and dignity. He has spent a lifetime working for justice and peace. And in his later years, he has made sure that young Mainers with humble beginnings like his in Waterville, right here, where his mother worked in a textile mill and his father was a janitor, that those young people can have a financial jumpstart toward a decent education and future. George Mitchell has been a judge, a U.S. senator, majority leader of the Senate, and the key negotiator for some of the most difficult and longstanding international conflicts of our time, those in Northern Ireland and the Middle East. He set Oliver North straight about God's role in politics, and he turned down a chance to be a U.S. Supreme Court justice because he felt it was more important to overhaul our nation's healthcare system. I would like to read an excerpt from an interview he gave to Harvard Business Review last year that sets the tone for this morning's discussion. And in this interview, Senator Mitchell talks about reaching out to Senator Bob Dole in 1989 after Senator Mitchell was elected majority leader and Senator Dole minority leader. Senator Mitchell promised never to personally criticize Senator Dole or surprise him, and he promised always to keep his word to the extent humanly possible. As he put it, "I could tell he was delighted. We shook hands, and never once since has a harsh word passed between us in public or in private. We disagreed on much legislation. We negotiated vigorously, but we succeeded in not making it personal and always trying to understand and accommodate each other." Now that's called civility. Please welcome Senator Mitchell.
Thank you all. Thank you all very much for your warm reception. Thank you for the good work that all of you are doing across our state to meet many of the needs of our people. Thank you, Bonnie, for that very generous introduction. And thanks to my dear friend, Cush Anthony. I just want to make one correction. You said he asked me to be here. Actually, he ordered me to be here. So, I think it was especially nice of all of you to choose Waterville as the place to meet. And I grew up just a short distance from here, attended all of the local schools, and was in Waterville just two nights ago when Kobe College and the Alphon Foundation announced a $20 million project for the revitalization of our downtown. This is a great community, and thank you for choosing it as the location for your meeting. I speak often. This is the first of four talks I'll give today. And I apologize for having to leave so soon, but I'm speaking at the University of Maine at Orono a short time later, so I'll have to leave as soon as my talk is over. But so I speak so often that, for me, frankly, the highlight of the program is the introduction. So, I thank Bonnie for those generous words. It's always nice, of course, to have people say pleasant things about you, particularly in front of many people you don't know. But there is a risk to it, that if you hear it often enough, you may begin to believe it. So I always like to begin with a story about introductions and an occasion on which I was brought back down to earth. I spent 5 years working on the peace process in Northern Ireland. When I completed my work, I returned to Maine, to my home on Mount Desert Island, and I wrote a book about my experience there. When the book was published, I went on a promotional tour around the country. I received many invitations, and in the process I learned the interesting fact that in the United States there are more Irish American organizations than there are Irish Americans. Every one of them invited me to come and speak. I couldn't go to all of them, but I did go to many. And as I travel the country speaking to these groups of Irish Americans, there developed among them an informal competition as to who could give the longest, frequently fantastic, and often ridiculous introductions of me. The proper reaction, of course, would have been for me to show some humility, to ask them please to keep it short, but I had an improper reaction. I loved it. I encouraged them. I scolded them when they left something out. One guy in Chicago spent about a half hour reading a long list of everything I've ever done in my life. It was especially interesting to me because I had not been aware of a lot of things that he referred to. So by the time I got to the last stop, which was in Stamford, Connecticut, they have a lively Irish-American society there, I was overly impressed with myself. I had a hard time squeezing my head through the front door. When I get in, the first person I encountered was an elderly woman who rushed up to me, very nervous and excited, shook my hand very, very vigorously, spent several minutes telling me how great I am, and then she concluded by saying, "I don't live anywhere near here. I drove 3 hours across the entire state of Connecticut just to meet you and ask you, please, would you autograph my poster?" And she handed me a poster with a photograph on it and a pen. I looked at it. I said, "I'm happy to sign your poster, but I think there's something I should tell you." She said, "What is it?" I said, "I'm not Henry Kissinger." It was a big photograph of Kissinger. She said, "You're not? Well, who are you anyway?" When I told her, she said, "Why, that's just terrible." She said, "I drove 3 hours to meet a great man named Kissinger, and all I've got is a nobody like you." I said, "Oh, I'm sorry you feel so bad. I wish there's something I could do to make you feel better." And after a moment's pause, she said, "Well, there is." When I asked what it was, she leaned forward. I leaned forward. Our foreheads were practically touching, and in a conspiratorial whisper, she said, "Nobody will ever know the difference." She said, "Would you mind signing Henry Kissinger's name to my poster?" So I did. And it's hanging today on her living room wall in eastern Connecticut, a daily reminder to me to listen intently and enjoy these kind of introductions, such as Bonnie gave, but not to take them too seriously. Well, I want to speak today on a couple of subjects, one which you chose, civility in politics, and another which I chose, about some of the major issues that are being discussed across our nation today. On Monday, just 3 days ago, the headline on the front page of the New York Times read, "Public rattled as campaign turns coarser. Talk of sexual abuse fuels voter anger." Now, of course, we have to keep this in perspective. Politics have always been rough and tumble in our country. In the early years, duels were common. And as one commentator noted, 3/4 of the duels that were fought were the result of political disputes. Amy Freed, a professor at the University of Maine, described the campaign for the presidency in 1800 in an article written and published in the Bangor Daily News. When they ran against each other in 1800, Jefferson's supporters said that President Adams had a hideous hermaphroditical character, which has neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. An advocate for Adams responded that if Jefferson won, quote, "murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will be openly taught and practiced. The air will be rent with the cries of the distressed, the soil will be soaked with blood and the nation dark with crimes. Well, today, Jefferson and Adams are both icons in our national history. And we include them, of course, in that August group that historians and we refer to as the Founding Fathers. But of course, the words I quoted were written, and they were read by few people. They did not come from the candidates themselves. In the recent campaign, many of the words are spoken. They are recorded and repeated endlessly on the cable television networks and in social media. So as a result, what is happening now is different. The effect is deeper, it's longer lasting, and it is much more negative. When a candidate for President of the United States, addressing a large crowd at an event covered on national television, used the F word to criticize adversaries, a line was crossed. Everyone makes mistakes, but this was not a one-time slip. It was rather consistent with a long pattern of language and behavior. Many defend such comments as, quote, telling it like it is, and not being politically correct. But this argument is based on an erroneous belief that being a straight talker somehow justifies or permits or is evidenced by the public use of vulgar, inflammatory, and insulting words. Nothing could be further from the truth. Swearing in public, insulting and threatening those who disagree is often a way to obscure the truth and to avoid serious discussion, not to engage in it. It's easy to rouse your most fervent supporters by cursing and demeaning your opponents. What is difficult is to publicly address complex issues in a serious way and in respectful language, respectful of both the American people and your opponents. That is the true practice of responsible democracy. The coarsening of public discussion has been abetted by a steep decline in the standards of journalism, always a vague concept and now virtually non-existent. Another negative factor is the spectacular increase in money pouring into our political system, corrupting our process, and undermining our institutions. There is much more money than ever in politics, but declining transparency, the opposite in both respects of what's needed in our democracy. Any of you who haven't seen it should view a segment that was broadcast on 60 Minutes on CBS on April 24th of this year. It featured a man named David Jolly, a Republican congressman from Florida. In a devastating indictment of the extent to which money has corrupted politics, Jolly courageously described in detail the emphasis of both parties in the House of Representatives on raising money rather than on serving constituents and solving problems. In the Citizens United decision and other recent cases, the Supreme Court severely limited the ability of Congress to impose reasonable limitations on contributions and expenditures in political campaigns. These will, in my judgment, go down in history as among the worst Supreme Court decisions ever made in American history. The court didn't create the problem. Money and politics have mixed from the dawn of civilization, but the court made a bad situation much worse. Among the most important issues facing our country in this election is whether the next Supreme Court will conclude that the current court is wrong and rule that it is constitutionally permissible to impose reasonable restraints to at least slow down the mad chase for money that our political process has become. Another reason for our political dysfunction is the hyper-partisanship that hobbles even the most well-intentioned of our elected leaders of both parties. It is an especially acute problem in the House of Representatives. From our nation's beginnings, the regular redrawing of district lines in the House has been manipulated by those whose election prospects were affected. But recent technological advances have made possible far more precise political drawing of lines. As a result, nearly 90% of the seats in the House of Representatives are not competitive in the general election. The real contests are in the primaries, in the nominating process. And because of the very low level of participation in the nominating process, disproportionate weight is given to the small but active groups on the extreme edges of the political spectrum. They tend to be the most ideological, most rigid, most unwilling to compromise. 16 states have efforts underway to reduce the extent of partisanship in the drawing of House district lines. If they and others are successful, fair and effective democracy will be greatly enhanced. You heard from Bonnie the story of my first meeting after I was elected Senate Majority Leader with Bob Dole. I believed that neither of us could do our jobs if our relationship was one of mistrust. So I told him how I intended to behave toward him. I set forth the most basic and simple standards of fairness, decency, and openness in our relationship. He was delighted. We shook hands, and as Bonnie noted, to this moment, never once has a harsh word passed between us in public or in private, even though we disagreed almost every day on almost every bill. We debated vigorously, but we did not make it personal. Often we reached agreement. When we could not, we left it to the Senate to decide. Sometimes my view prevailed, sometimes his view prevailed, but we tried very hard to make our debate focused on issues. We recognized that we had an obligation of loyalty to the senators who had elected us to be their leaders, but we also knew that we had a higher loyalty to the people of this country. Too many of our political leaders today give lip service to this proper hierarchy of loyalty and too often act to the contrary out of pure party loyalty. Too many demonize their opponents in ways that uses and fosters disrespectful and inflammatory language. Every citizen of Maine and every other state in the country can play a role in reversing these harmful trends. We all can speak out as individuals and in organized groups like yours. We can contribute our time, our effort, our money to those who share our beliefs. But most importantly, we can vote. It is through the ballot box that we not only choose our public officials, but we express our values as a nation. I want to discuss briefly another issue that's the subject of much discussion today, and one in which I know that your organization and your members are active. We're fortunate to be Americans, citizens of a country that, despite its many serious imperfections, is still, in my opinion, the most open, the most free, the most just society in the world. The United States is the world's dominant power, and it will continue to be as far into the future as human beings can see. Although we face serious challenges at home and abroad, our military strength is by far the greatest in all of human history, and our economy is still the world's largest and strongest and most successful by any measure. But the American people are fearful and anxious. On first impression, it seems contradictory, but it is, in fact, understandable and has occurred many times in the past in our country and in many others. The Industrial Revolution was one of the great turning points in human history. It began about 250 years ago in England, as machines replaced men in the production of goods. The prospect of high levels of unemployment caused widespread fear and anxiety. There was unrest, there was violence, there was some exploitation, and there was much misery. But there also was a massive increase in productivity that created new goods, new services, new jobs, raising the overall standard of living of the whole society. Over the following century, that revolution spread to most of the Western world and especially to a newly free United States of America, where freedom, innovation, new people, and new ideas propelled us to the forefront of nations in the world. Today, we and everyone else in the world are passing through a revolution in technology and commerce that future historians will judge to be as significant a turning point in history as was the Industrial Revolution. Its effects are accelerated and intensified by the dramatic growth since the Second World War of the international trade in goods and services and in the movement of people across national borders. The combined effects have been, as is often the case in human affairs, both positive and negative. There has been the creation of wealth without precedent in all of history. But that wealth is not being distributed throughout the whole society, and the growth in our economy is uneven across the country. As a result, many parts of our country are struggling. Many of our fellow citizens are victims, not beneficiaries, of the revolution in technology. Neither we nor any other society has yet devised fully effective policies to mitigate the adverse effects of increased trade and technological development, so that many in our country are enduring difficulty, even as so many others of us benefit. To do that, to figure out a way that we can continue to derive the benefits of change, we need to mitigate the disadvantages to those who don't benefit. That means we have to have the unity of our people. We have to have a unity of national purpose. We have to have a national commitment to make good health, good education, and good jobs available to all Americans. We need to recognize that we are more than just a collection of individuals. We are citizens of a free society from which we derive great benefits and to which we owe great responsibilities. Most modern nations began as homogeneous groups in race, in language, in religion. But the success of America has been the work of people from every part of the world, of different backgrounds, different religions, different languages, all coming together, committed not to a race or a religion, but to an ideal, best expressed by our greatest president, Abraham Lincoln, to form a more perfect union. That's also the meaning of the simple but powerful statement, E pluribus unum, from many, one. We've done so imperfectly, slowly, sometimes making huge mistakes and tragic misjudgments, but always in the end, overcoming each challenge and emerging a better and stronger people and nation. Fear and anxiety and harsh responses in times of transition are not new. Even the sources of that fear and anxiety are not new. For most of the first century of its existence, America welcomed immigrants to help fill a vast continent. The first restrictions on immigration came in 1882 when the Congress enacted a law whose title was blunt. Nowadays, members of Congress have devised fancy titles to bills, which often don't describe accurately what's in the bill and frequently are the opposite of what's in the bill. But back then, they were more blunt. So in 1882, Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act. It was a reaction to the entry of Chinese workers who helped build a major railroad across the country. In 1906, a major earthquake devastated San Francisco. Unable to accommodate all of the children whose schools were destroyed, the city not only tried to rebuild the school, they tried to limit and reduce the school-age population. And they passed an ordinance which prohibited any child of Japanese ancestry, even those born in the United States, from entering public schools. Even earlier, from the very beginning, when Spanish, Dutch, English, and French settlers fought one another and the Native Americans for control of North America, there was discrimination against, opposition to, and demonization of those who were different. Everyone has heard the words Wall Street. Where did they originate? Well, it's a small street just above the southern tip of the island of Manhattan. In the early 17th century, it marked the northern boundary of the Dutch settlement that they called New Amsterdam. And it was there that the Dutch built a wall to keep out those they feared. Not, as most believe, the Native Americans, but the English, who had settled New England and were working their way south. And as we now know, the Dutch did have much to fear because New Amsterdam became and remains New York. Later, successive waves of Italians and Irish, of Jews and Catholics, and many others were met with hostility, with exclusion, with racial and religious stereotyping, and with discrimination. Every Irish American is aware of the signs that were pervasive across New York and other major cities. Irish need not apply. And the cartoons published in magazines and newspapers of the day depicting the Irish as subhuman. Every Italian American remembers how all Italians were stigmatized because of the few who were mafia criminals. The Ku Klux Klan is best remembered for its violence against African Americans in the South in the 1880s and 90s. But in fact, the Klan reached its peak in the North in the 1920s. Based on extreme and virulent hostility to Catholics and Jews. And other than African Americans, no group of Americans has suffered from discrimination more or longer than have Jews. And yet, take just a moment to think back over our recent history and see the tremendous contributions made to and for our country by Irish Americans, by Italian Americans, by Asian Americans, by African Americans, by Catholics, by Jews, by others. The earliest of them withstood the hostility and hatred, and sometimes the violence. They got their hands on the bottom rung of the ladder, and they pulled themselves up. And their children and grandchildren stood on their shoulders and have climbed even higher, in some cases, to the pinnacles of success. Now, of course, every rational American knows that we can no longer accept everyone who wants to live in our country. We cannot have a policy of completely open immigration. Common sense and national survival makes clear that in our national interest, we need policies that place fair and realistic limits on how many can enter and who they are. But our national debate has recently been completely negative, focused almost entirely on who cannot enter and why, how we can best keep them out, and whether we can or should throw out the 11 million who entered illegally, and if so, how. The recent controversy also is over whether a religious test can be applied or is even constitutional. I believe we also should focus on who we want to enter and how we can continue to replenish our society with new people to their benefit and ours. Surely, we have the capacity as Americans to engage in a serious national debate based on fact and grounded in reason and hope to establish a sensible policy on immigration that meets the many national interests that are affected by this issue. And in so doing, we must keep in mind that from the very beginning, America has been enriched by new people, new ideas, new energy, new vision. And that continues today. Three of the most valuable and successful businesses in America and indeed in the world are Apple, Amazon, and Google. Apple was created by Steve Jobs, whose father was born in Syria. Amazon was created by Jeff Bezos, whose adoptive father was born in Cuba. And a co-founder of Google was Sergey Brin, who himself was born in Russia. I ask you two rhetorical questions to think about as you drive home today. Would the United States be a better country today if they had not been admitted? And secondly, of equal importance, what do you think the chances are that Steve Jobs would have created Apple had he lived his life in Damascus, or Jeff Bezos in Havana, or Sergey Brin in Russia? Genius knows no language, no race, no religion. It can be found wherever human beings exist, but it is more likely to flourish where there is freedom, education, and opportunity for all, where innovation is encouraged and success is celebrated and applauded. And that surely is the case now in our country, despite all of the negative talk. Just a few examples. I spoke last night in Falmouth, and I said some of what I said here, and a fellow got up afterward and said, "You left out an important fact, Senator, so I don't want to leave it out today." He pointed out, he said, I haven't had a chance to check it, but I have no reason to doubt it, that Americans have received several Nobel Prizes this year, and each of them is an immigrant to our country. Think also about the fact that although Americans comprise 6% of the world's population, 6%, 9 of the 10 most valuable business brands in the world are American, as are 15 of the world's top 20 universities. 91% of online searches are done through American companies, and 99% of smartphones in the world operate on American-made operating systems. The reality that our strength, and it is a great strength, lies ultimately in our ideals is one of the principal reasons for our success. Military strength, economic strength, they're both important, even necessary, to defend and secure our people and our values. But in the United States, they have been infused with the ideals that are the basis and the promise of American life. not easily summarized, but surely they include the sovereignty of the people, individual liberty, our highest value, opportunity for every American, an independent judiciary, and the rule of law applied equally to everyone and critically applied to the government itself. Our Constitution is more than just a collection of laws and procedures. It is a work of political and literary genius. It also is a statement of our ideals and a symbol of American values, especially and most especially the principles of equal justice and equal rights and equal opportunity for every person in our society, whatever their status, whatever their background, whatever color they are, whatever religion they practice, they are Americans. And if they are, they have the same rights that every person in this room has. Despite all of the negative talk, despite the drumbeat of tragedy that so dominates our news today, I believe deeply in the promise and the future of America. I believe in the American dream because I have lived it. When I grew up just a few yards from here, my mother was an immigrant herself from Lebanon. She could not read or write. She spent 50 years working the night shift in textile mills in this area. My father was the orphan son of Irish immigrants. He left school at the age of 10, and he spent his entire life working at menial jobs, including the last 20 years of his life as a janitor. But because of their efforts, and more importantly, because of the openness of American society, I, their son, was able to get an education and to become the majority leader of the United States Senate. And our task must be to see to it that every child in America, every child, whatever their background, has the same chance to go as high and as far as their talent and their willingness to work will take them. So we do have much to be concerned about. We are imperfect, as are all human beings and all human institutions. Each of us daily fails to live up to the standard we set for ourselves. And collectively as a society, that is even more true. But the greatness of America lies in a willingness to be self-critical, a willingness to confront error, and a willingness to try to correct the mistakes in the past. So while we have much to be concerned about, we have much more to be thankful for. And I'm convinced that the 21st century, our country will in every way be better, stronger, and I hope more unified than ever. May we have the wisdom to use that strength to extend education, opportunity, and hope to more and more people in our own country and around the world. Thank you very much for having me. I wish you a good conference and a good day. I didn't realize I was going to be asked questions.
Oh, why is it?
Go right ahead.
How much time do we have for questions? Just
at least 15 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
That's time for lots of questions, but my answers are pretty long. So,
so thank you very much for those hopeful words and putting what's going on in our country right now in perspective, historical perspective, and giving us hope. Here's a question. Senator, in these times when it seems division, anger, and violence define our national, state, and local discourse, what specific challenges would you issue to our communities of faith in Maine? More specifically, what is the leadership role that you want to assign us in the effort to move toward mutual respect?
Well, I think it would be presumptuous of me to set your agenda. But since you asked the question directly, I'll give you my response. And it ties in somewhat to a portion of my remarks. We are seeing an unprecedented increase in wealth around the world and particularly in the United States. At the same time, we are seeing a massive gap in accessibility to wealth and to things in life that are possible as a result. Our economic system and our political system are, in my judgment, the most successful in all of human history because they recognize and are grounded in the realities of human nature. And that means a free market system, which is open to everyone to strive, to work, to succeed if possible. But we also recognize that not just in our society, but in every society in all of human history, that while we say in our Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, we know that describes rights and citizenship, not physical and mental attributes. Not everyone is equal. Some are stronger. Some are bigger. Some are smarter. Some are more aggressive. And so in a highly competitive system, which we believe and I believe is the best suited for the general advance of society, there will inevitably be those who don't participate in a successful way, who are left behind. I said in my remarks how well I think we've done. And as I look back over the many years of my life, I think our society has progressed in truly remarkable ways. But in one major way, I believe our society has not progressed. And that is, I believe a child born today, here in Maine, even here in Waterville, in the circumstances into which I was born, has less chance for upward mobility than I had. And I think that is not only a tragedy for those individuals, it is a loss for society. Because one of the benefits we know is that when people are engaged and productive and succeeding, they are lifting the whole society. We are all better off when fellow citizens do well, in however you define that term. And so I think we have a truly enormous responsibility to do our best to make it possible for each person to have the same chance for success. I think of it in personal terms that I have. When I left the Senate, I started a scholarship program for needy Maine children. So far, we've given out more than 2,500 scholarships, more than $14 million in direct assistance. And I did so because as I traveled Maine, I went to every high school in Maine. I spoke the graduation of every high school in Maine. I saw so many children. I saw in their eyes and their voices mirror images of myself at their age, insecure, uncertain. I didn't know whether I'd even go to college well into my senior year in high school. People reached out and helped me for no reason other than they wanted to help a young man in whom they saw a promise, even though I didn't see any myself. And so my goal in life, what keeps me going every day, is that my goal is to make sure that every single child in Maine, every single one who has talent and willingness to work, is going to be able to get a college education. Now, I know for certain I cannot succeed in a precise mathematical sense, but if I work every day of my life toward that goal, I think I can do a lot of good. And I think all of us have to do that individually and collectively. And one of the things we've learned in the miracles of modern science that so infuse our lives is that what happens in the earliest days and months of a human being's life can have a decisive impact on that human being's capacity for growth and development throughout their lives. We have got to do so much better in terms of early childhood access to nutrition, intellectual stimulation, and care. I want to say to you, right here in Waterville, in the elementary school, which is named after me, there is a problem of many children who they get fed Monday through Friday, or they come into school on Monday, they haven't eaten over the weekend. No 6-, 7-, 8-year-old child can possibly learn without being nutritious. The principal said to me, he said, when they come in on Monday, I cry when I see them. And so we have started a small, modest program to figure out a way to get food to children on weekends in the United States of America in the 21st century. And you multiply that around the state, you multiply it around the country. We can do better than that. For most of us, there's so much food, we have to work hard to eat less.
Yeah.
And yet we think of young kids in our own society who aren't being fed. It shouldn't happen in America. It shouldn't happen in the 21st century. So I think my challenge to you is to keep up the good work you're doing. But if you have time and effort and resources, I think you should focus on this issue of children's nutrition and early intellectual stimulation, which I assure you is a huge problem, not just in this community or in this state, but all across this country.
Thank you. Here's another question specifically about civil discourse. If you were running against a candidate who lied and fomented unrest and perpetuated bigotry, how would you respond to that person civilly in debates and on the campaign trail?
Well, I think anybody who runs for public office first has to be ambitious. You have to have a certain amount of drive to do it, because it can be very difficult, can often both physically and mentally. It's also very tough on families. But at the same time, if you're going to do it, you have to do it full measure. And that means I felt when statements were made that were false that they deserved to be rebutted. In respectful language, you don't have to call someone a name, but you point out, and I tried whenever I could to point out what I felt were inaccurate statements and to try to provide a corrective response. That can be very difficult to do because it's almost impossible to replicate whatever audience receives a false message. If it's on television, you can't ever be certain that the same people are going to hear the response that heard the initial statement. But I think, and I tried hard, as I said in my relations with Senator Dolan, with others, to be respectful, but also to represent the point of view that I felt was the right one and to correct misstatements that were made, and the most difficult thing of all, to correct my own misstatements. The fact is that, like everybody else, I've made mistakes in things I've said and done, and I can remember more than once as Senate Majority Leader walking down to the well of the Senate to take my position in the Senate Majority Leader's desk and stand up and acknowledge that I'd made an error, something that I'd said had been mistaken. First time I did it, boy, it was really hard. after a while, I got used to it. the air, of course, now is filled with misstatements. It's very difficult. I find it difficult myself, and I'm sure every citizen finds it difficult to keep up with the competing statements, the inaccuracies that are made. You didn't ask this, and I know this is the last question, so I want to use this as a mechanism for make a point different from the question but arising from it that I think should be made. One of the most conspicuous absences in the three debates that were held was any serious discussion of what I think is one of the most serious problems confronting people of our country and the world, and that is climate change and global warming. Now, this is not a partisan group, and I don't want to make this partisan. I've tried not to. But it is a fact that there were 17 candidates who sought the Republican nomination for the presidency. And all 17 of them denied the existence of climate change and opposed any effort to do something about it. I find that shocking. Contrary to the assertions, the current nominee says that it's a hoax created by the Chinese to hurt America. I find that an incredible statement. One candidate said there is no evidence to support the conclusion that the climate is changing and that man-made activities have anything to do with it. The evidence is overwhelming. And more than just this issue, which is of critical importance, on which we must take action, more than that is the denial of science, the refusal to acknowledge scientific reality. In the 21st century and beyond, no society will succeed if it denies the plain facts of science. Science and faith had for many centuries of human existence an uneasy relationship. But we've reached a point now where reasonable men and women believe that they can coexist well together. There once was a time when many people believed the earth was flat. There once was a time when many people believed that the sun revolved around the earth. We know now those were not the case, and the reality of science has become what we consider knowledge. And in our society today, it is almost incredible to hear the statements made denying the existence of science in connection with climate change and in existence with the science of evolution and with a whole host of other activities. This is not just a question of individual belief. People can believe what they want. This is a question of national survival. We are the dominant power. We have a responsibility to educate our children to the realities of science on which most human progress is based. And we're at least not fully meeting our national obligation in that regard. We need children who recognize science, who do not fear science, who understand the realities of change and science and want, whose objective is to harness those to the benefit of all the members of our society. And I just come up with a new suggestion for you. Promote science. It will sometimes produce unpleasant realities for us. But the answer is not to deny the realities. The answer is to understand them and to cope with them and to harness them for the benefit of all of our citizens. Thank you very much. Good luck to you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was former Senator George Mitchell. This program is available on our website, mainepublic.org, where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast. Charles Beck is the executive producer for Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward.